to Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, April 30th, 2020. Tonight, I'm your host, Ari Clark, and joining me are Kelly Schwartz.
Yo.
And Josh Mitchell.
Hey.
This week, we want to give you a break from virus-related news and highlight some science stories from the past few months that kind of missed out on their media spotlight. But one quick thing before we do. We here at Perpetual Notion Machine want to remind our audience that the vast majority of the science you read about and that we cover on the show, including coronavirus research and stories that we're going to talk about tonight, are made possible by federal dollars that come ultimately from you, the taxpayer. That means that scientists, including the scientists on our show, work for you. Feel free to reach out to scientists when you need help reading the news and figuring out what's true and what's not and what good sources of information are. And you can reach out to us at PNM or experts listed at the UW-Madison Experts database. Contact information and links to the database are going to be listed on our Facebook page and also on our show's webpage, which is on the WART website, wartfm.org. With that being said, let's jump in. Kelly, what do you got?
Oh, we got all kinds of fun stuff for folks. It turns out science doesn't really stop just because people are staying home. So one of the interesting updates that might have been missed is the development of a mutant enzyme that can vastly improve the recycling of plastic bottles. This is something that's very near and dear to my heart. And it doesn't necessarily pertain to this article in particular, but one big concern living near our beautiful Great Lakes, living near, you know, this enormous watershed, is the amount of plastics that are found in waterways now, microplastics, parts of bigger plastic that are broken down. So in addition to this, we try to be as cautious about our use as possible. You know, now that people know about microbeads, we're not doing that as much, but it's still just impossible. If you go along the shores of Lake Michigan in the springtime, you'll see tons of plastic. So we're just swimming in plastic. And part of the reason for this is because it's just not feasible for us right now to be able to recycle plastic. At least something like PET, PET, it's the type one. This just needs to be made, and then some of it's broken down, and only about a third of this actually gets recycled, and this turns into something that's a lower strength version of the original. So when you melt down different colored plastics, you can get an ugly color from manufacturers, you know, don't actually want to reuse because it's not real good looking, and nobody wants a low quality shampoo bottle. Unfortunately, we are just sort of stuck right now. So a lot of times these plastics get used for things like low quality carpet, or they honestly just end up in landfills or incinerated, even worse. So we do need plastic in our society until we figure out a way to both politically and scientifically move beyond our current practices. We're kind of stuck with it. So we can use science to solve this problem. So scientists have been searching for microbes that produce enzymes. So enzymes are, think of them as little tools to change things, right? So a tool is used to change something. If you think of like a wood plane, smooths out wood. If you think of a saw, it cuts wood in half, you know, things like that. So there are a lot of different enzymes, a lot of different tools that cells can use to do a lot of different things. So scientists reason that there's things like PET plastic out there in the environment. Let's see what the natural diversity has already created to kind of break down this polymer. And I'll stop right there too. A polymer is a chain of repeating units, right? So you can think of that as like a necklace strung together, right? You have repeating beads that are kind of on a chain held together. And the main problem right now is that we can't reuse these beads as much as we'd like to make a brand new necklace because they're just stuck together too closely. So if you can find a way to break those apart and restring them, that's what we're looking for. So it turns out the scientists were actually able to find a useful enzyme in Osaka, Japan, in a compost heap of all things, which just makes my heart leap because this is the true DIY, right? In a compost heap, you know, you can find all these cool tools for biotech and discovery. The enzyme they called leaf branch compost cutinase, or LLC for short. Not sure what LLC stands for, but that's what the authors use. So they have an example of this enzyme, but because this enzyme evolved to break down leaf resins, it's, you know, it's about as sharp as a baked potato. So in order to sharpen this thing up a little bit, they used protein engineering to create a bunch of different mutations of this enzyme, and then just sort of took the ones that worked. They used selection processes, and they were able to find an enzyme that could convert 90% of the recycled plastic back into starting materials, those beads. And those beads in this case are ethylene glycol and terephthalate, I believe is how it's pronounced. I've never said that word out loud before. So they're able to put these beads, you know, separate these beads out and leave behind the dyes and other additives. So this is great because this enzyme is very specific to this type of plastic. So if you've got a whole mishmash of plastic, you've got contaminated plastic, people don't separate, you know, I mean, I know everybody hates those guys, but you know, you got to separate your plastics, right? Don't be that person. But in case you got a batch of plastic that's mixed, it's great for this kind of a purpose because it'll just break down the PET and you'll be able to isolate those downstream. So this work was done in collaboration with scientists at Carbios, which is a sustainable plastics company in France, and a protein engineering expert from the University of Toulouse, Isabella André. So the André lab helped design the enzyme, and then Carbios provided a lot of the funding and the sort of impetus for this work. So they're working on scaling up and exploring feasibility and profitability, and it's great because the product that they have is very high quality, and that allows, you know, purveyors to sell this for more money. So it makes this recycled product much more valuable, which incentivizes people to adopt the new technology. So yeah, I think it's pretty cool. We can post a link to the article and maybe to the primary literature too. If anybody's interested in looking at that, it's a really nice, straightforward, if you're familiar with reading these papers, it's pretty straightforward. They provide, you know, the enzyme map. They talk about the different groups. They do a little bit of preliminary research. It's a nice little Nature paper.
So cool. I love hearing about enzymes that we find in nature to do jobs that otherwise, like, maybe we would think of more industrial chemistry would be needed.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They're tools, right? I mean, there's... Mm-hmm. For every compound that exists, there's something that wants to eat it.
Right.
So it's just a matter of looking in the right spot. It's really cool to me, again, you know, they found this in a compost heap. You know, who knows what's living in your compost heap at home?
Right. Or what it's eating.
Or what it's eating. Yeah. So.
Awesome.
Cool stuff.
Well, Jack, you know, if you don't mind me jumping in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, one thing I just wanted to say with plastics, what I always think are just inherently interesting is that plastics sometimes have this weird feel to us, but inherently they fall into organic chemistry, right? Which I think mm-hmm. always kind of feels weird that you think of organic chemistry as maybe this kind of life-based thing, but really a lot of our plastics are all carbon-based. And I remember when I was going through undergrad and one of the first chemistry classes we have, you have this lab course and you make plastic. And it feels so weird to think plastics are just these long chains of carbons. And, you know, to think that plastics, which, you know, we think of as this totally unique category, like, oh, you know what, this isn't a bark, this isn't a leaf, and it's unique, it's this plastic. But really, it is kind of this odd natural polymer that we've kind of developed and changed to, you know, give us different plasticities, different textures and things like that. But, you know, it's the same thing. Natural rubber latex comes from a rubber tree in the Amazon, which I think is the same thing. You don't think, oh, wow, rubber latex, right? That, you know, that's got to be homemade. No, that's from a tree. So always blows my mind.
Yeah, that's the cyberpunk future that I want to live in, you know, where we're all harvesting polymers from goat's milk or something, right? You know, where you just brew up a big batch of plastic and then you have the kids spend the afternoon spinning it into thread or something. It's like the new gingham. I mean,
I'm here for it. Yeah. No, that's really cool. Our next story actually is kind of a special one because it comes out of a lab in Josh and my graduate department. And actually one of our buddies is the first author on this paper. Josh, you want to give us the scoop?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So first and foremost, a shout out to Hugo Lee. the primary author on the paper who did the work. Hugo is the grad school champion, okay?
A third-year grad student with a first author paper. My man.
Oh, yeah. Our man, Hugo the Laser Lee. Okay, so Hugo actually works on type 1 diabetes. And so things to consider, right? There's two forms of diabetes that we currently understand, right? There's type 1, there's type 2s. Whether there's type 3, I don't know, but hey, you never. I don't want to take away from that. Okay, so type 1 diabetes, which actually used to be called juvenile diabetes, is quite different from type 2. So type 1 is an autoimmune disease, which is very inherently interesting and entirely different from type 2. And so what ends up happening is that your own immune system, specifically these cells called T cells, which are these immune cells, under normal circumstances, they recognize kind of these foreign objects in your body. Now, that seems a little more generalized, but things like maybe viruses, bacteria, stuff, right? They have special ways of recognizing things that shouldn't be in the body. So what T cells do is they recognize them. And as soon as T cells, they have this whole cascade of recognition, which then leads to breakdown. And you know, in a normal, healthy immune system, this is wonderful. Issue is in type 1 diabetes, it recognizes your own tissue. And so that's a major problem, especially because it targets the cells that make insulin, which are called pancreatic beta cells. Now, there are pancreatic alpha cells. I'm not going to talk about that. We're just interested in the beta cells. So what happens is your body slowly kills all of these beta cells. And so your body isn't able to produce any insulin at all. And while you can get type 1 diabetes really at any time during your life, it's rarer oftentimes to see it later in life. And hence why it was used to be called juvenile diabetes is because it developed early in life. Usually you see it kind of fully developing by adolescence into your teenage years. And so, like I said, just a quick thing, right? This is in contrast to type 2 diabetes, which is where your body can no longer use insulin effectively. And this is where your blood just accumulates all this glucose. And type 2 diabetes is a combination of genetic factors and also lifestyle choices too. And those are pretty broad terms, and that's the truth. Type 2 diabetes in its onset is relatively broad. Okay, that's enough of that. So, you know, what's the issue with type 1 diabetes? Well, you have to chronically manage your blood glucose, right? Your blood sugar, which is incredibly difficult because keeping it in the natural maintenance that your body has is not easy, right? What's a good comparison? You know, it's like trying to take care and maintain a healthy amount of dishes without a dishwasher, right? Like it takes a lot more work. You know, you got to look at the dishes, you got to wash them, right? A dishwasher, you put them in and it takes care of itself almost. And so one of those issues is that when you have these wild fluctuations of your blood sugar going up, going down, when your body's very good at managing it in a pretty normal level, often you get a lot of issues with like just general tissue damage. Your body becomes more stressed. And so because of that, it can shorten lifespan. But going along with that, right, you have to maintain your insulin. You have to inject yourself with insulin. That's relatively expensive. Going along with that, there are certain ways that you can help manage how your blood, you know, blood glucose through diet, through exercise, right? But those can be pretty dramatic lifestyle changes too, which are inherently quite difficult to take care of. And so, you know, it's thought that upwards of 20 million people are affected worldwide with type 1 diabetes. So it's a really important question of how can we figure out to, you know, help alleviate the symptoms of type 1 diabetes, especially because this is often something that is associated with kind of these general principles. Type 1 diabetes is often kind of an immune disease, which is inherently difficult. So what the Engen lab did is they looked at different techniques to perhaps kind of rescue cells. And hold on a moment. Ari, are you getting this horrible feedback?
Yes.
Okay, good. I just thought I'd check. It wasn't just me. I'm going to quick try. All right, so what the Engen lab did is they looked at ways that they could modulate the kind of the immune targeting towards beta cells, right? And so what they looked at is there's a lot of different pathways in cells that elicit a lot of different effects. And so one of them that's relatively interesting is kind of this, what we like to call this unfolded protein response. It's called UPR. And so what happens in your cells is that, you know, normal cells, right, almost like a little construction yard, things get built and they get shipped away, like in a little factory, right? You build things, you ship them out. Now, the problem is if you're in a factory and you suddenly realize that everything that's coming out is disastrously broken apart or just doesn't look good, what you have to do is you have to be able to, oh, whew, no more of the ringing noise. That's fantastic. So,
great.
Oh, that's nice. Okay, so like I said, like a factory, like a factory that's successful, normally normal products are going out. A factory that isn't successful, you have all this discombobulated stuff. And so what you want to do is you want to shut down the factory. That's the unfolded protein response. It causes the shutdown. And so what they did is they deleted this gene called IRE1 alpha and beta cells. And what they found is that when you remove this gene, which is involved in this unfolded protein response, suddenly it's like the beta cells are undergoing a disguise, which is actually from the PI, Dr. Faiza Engen. You know, this was her great comment, which is really cool to see. And so what ends up happening is that the cells are in kind of this adult stage. And what they do is they almost move back into almost like an adolescent, a prepubescent stage. So they what they call kind of reverting back up the cell line. So it's almost like they're not as differentiated as we like to call. So differentiation is when you move forward, when they get to kind of these terminal cells, right? They've got its full purpose. So they were kind of reverting up the stream. And what was interesting is they acted like these reverted cell lines where they expressed different hormones. They kind of took on a different appearance. But what ended up happening is that after a period of time, you see differentiation. So they turn back into beta cells. And suddenly the immune system no longer targets them. T cells, you know, our immune cell that recognizes these foreign antigens, no longer recognizes it. And suddenly you have a healthy immune system that doesn't seemingly recognize these cells. And it worked quite nicely. And so suddenly you have a whole rescue of this disease in mice, which is absolutely amazing to see.
Right. That's so cool. And I don't know if I missed you saying this during our technical snafu, but Dr. Engen didn't expect that result when they made that mutation, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's entirely true. It was a total surprise. And she went and told Hugo and the other lab members, why don't you check this again just to make sure? Because it is an incredibly odd thing to see.
So how do you, and maybe you said this also, but how might this therapy be packaged for medical use?
Yeah, so it's very preliminary, I think is the best way to put, right? Genetically engineering people itself, right? If you were going to go on that route, things like we've talked about before with CRISPR, right? Like the kids in China who underwent CRISPR to try and protect against like HIV exposure. CRISPR is still a developing therapy. And so there's concerns because CRISPR isn't 100% accurate. So you would be wary of using it immediately because if you wanted to do some genetic editing, you might have some problems. And you don't want off-target effects, especially with the unfolded protein response, which is a very important pathway in cells. You know, you could look at doing...
Because there are gene replacement therapies out there from adeno-vector viruses, right?
Yeah, and so those are some really interesting techniques, right, where you're using more of like a viral vector. And so it's an interesting question of kind of like the application. Because mm-hmm. could you use kind of a virus-based delivery system to reprogram and get them to kind of undifferentiate and then redifferentiate? I don't know. I think that's what we're going to see in the future, which is very exciting.
Right. Cool. Or just to target maybe the ER stress response pathway or the unfolded protein response pathways that IRE1 acts in a different way that is not the same as knocking out that protein.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Sure. Maybe something a little bit more subtle.
Exactly. So I think that's what's also going to be really interesting too, was this deletion related specifically to this pathway? Because when you see, you know, like reverting to a more naive state, right, going to more of a pluripotent state, is that related to this IRE response or in, you know, messing with UPR? Is that maybe related to something else? So I'll be very interested to see what future papers are going to, how they're going to speak to this event and what it really means.
Right. That's really cool. But I think that in the interest of time, we've got to move on to our last story for tonight, which is about space and cool space objects. So actually, the story kind of started at the end of 2017, where astronomers working at these big telescopes in Hawaii saw this space rock passing in our solar system near the sun, and they named it Oumuamua, which is Hawaiian for a messenger traveling, or a messenger from afar arriving first. And so these scientists noted this object, which was really odd for a couple reasons. One is the shape. So this Oumuamua was more like long and skinny and cigar shape. That is not typically seen for like space debris or space rocks. And they also noted that it was spinning pretty fast, I believe. And that was just another oddity that they noted. And so since 2017, people have been kind of speculating, like, what could this rock be? How could this be shaped in this way? Like, what led to the formation of this peculiarly shaped rock? And then even it had some scientists and astronomers speculating that it could be extraterrestrial in origin, which is pretty neat.
That was Avi Loeb from Harvard, I think, had a paper that was published in 2018 or 2019 about it.
Yeah. And so recently, in this month, some astronomers from France used computer simulations to try to figure out what some possible non-extraterrestrial origins for this Oumuamua rock would be. And unfortunately or fortunately, they did find a plausible explanation that does not involve aliens. They think that Oumuamua originated from a planet that got too close to its home star, think of like our sun, and that the gravitational force of that star shredded the planet apart in a way that created a bunch of long shards. They call this process tidal disruption, which has to do with the gravity of the star and the forces that would cause on a planet.
That's that's some Star Trek interpretation.
Oh yeah.
Aren't the latest arcs of Star Trek about like Romulus blowing up?
Maybe. Yeah. That's not one of my fandoms, unfortunately.
Well, it is, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But just a slight correction, it would definitely be extraterrestrial. This is definitely an extraterrestrial origin. We didn't shoot it out there from here.
Yeah. Kelly, do you have another bit about aliens?
I mean, just to follow up on another possibility that this leading he's from Harvard, so you can totally trust him. But one of the hypotheses he kind of threw out there to get published was that Oumuamua could be a probe that was deliberately sent to the solar system by an alien civilization. Now, what proof does he have of this? None. This is all completely speculation. But as every good scientist know, it always starts with a hypothesis and observations. And speaking of observations, Shali.
I know the CIA will say, what you hear is all hearsay. Wish someone would tell me what was right.
As has been widely reported, the Navy has confirmed UFO videos posted by formerly Blink-182's Tom DeLonge are in fact genuine. But I think all believers already believe this. But yes, so this is the latest in a series of slow concessions that the government has made to confirm the authenticity of some videos that were posted back in 2017, I want to say. And these videos displayed aircrafts moving in a way that is not consistent with current known technology. So the Navy has said little more than, as of last year, that they were investigating claims from Navy and Air Force pilots as being credible. And it sounds from the eyewitness accounts that there have been a lot of sightings, not just a few, but a pretty consistent amount of sightings, and that the videos that have been, the Tic Tac videos that have been circulated, that they are genuine. So so not for nothing. It's pretty interesting. Nobody's asking me to speculate on the nature of these crafts, but I can tell you that I did find from 2005 a Nature newspaper article about anti-gravity craft slips past patent officers. So there are people out there that are patenting anti-gravity technology that would be somewhat consistent with the way these ships move, which seems to be at odds with propulsion as we know it, being able to stop and turn and take off in ways that our best jet pilots can't maintain. So, very interesting. We'll follow up so now that we've got some evidence that this is, you know, this is a genuine genuine phenomenon that can be observed. I'll be interested to see kind of what comes out, you know, what other explanations. I mean, aliens is only one explanation for what this could be. There's a lot of other, you know, less aliens-y explanations.
For sure. Oh boy. So Oumuamua, probably not aliens. But that's not to say that they're not out there.
Oh, yeah. And if you want to tell us what your theory is, you can find us on social media. We'd love to know. We can bring science into this conversation. There's a room here. There's a seat here for science, right?
For sure. Josh, you have anything to add about the space stuff?
Aliens. Yeah, apparently the octopus is thought to possibly come from space, too. So, I mean, man, that's a mic drop right there.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to talk about that more on another episode. I gotta hear about it. Do you have a 1 minute blurb of how?
Oh, about it? Oh yeah, it's crazy. So 33 different scientists, including immunologists and some, like an astrobiologist, astrophysicist. I gotta double check that one. But what was really interesting is that they think of it maybe as more of a thought process, just to say, hey, what if animals on our planet did come from space? What would that look like? Because octopi are so weird. They got crazy eyes, they got weird genes, and how they develop doesn't entirely make sense with how it fits. So they're questioning, could octopuses be from space? Maybe.
Cool. Well, unfortunately, that's our show. So thank you guys for tuning in.
Unfortunately.
I want to talk more about the space octopi, but we are out of time. I want to thank you all for tuning in, and especially thank my co-hosts Kelly and Josh. You rock.
Thanks.
And an extra, extra huge thanks to our engineer and fearless leader, Charlie Pittman. For more information on this show, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at Perpetual Notion Machine. Space invader blasting through the night.